The jury says guilty. The judge passes sentence, the gavel bangs down, and the criminal goes to prison. Perry Mason made it look so easy on TV. The criminal justice system we deal with in real life is a whole lot messier than that, as we learn by daily reading of news stories of crime and criminals and trials. Today's guest finds the real criminal justice system lacking, explaining the title of his book, Unfair, The New Science of Criminal Injustice. Adam Benferrato wrote it, and he's a lawyer for start. He graduated from Harvard Law, served as federal appellate law clerk, and worked for a law firm. He's a prolific writer with many scholarly articles, essays, and opinion columns to his credit, and he's currently associate professor of law at Drexel University in Philadelphia. Adam Benferrato, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
It's a pleasure.
So we start a serious discussion of the criminal justice system, I like this, by talking about Monty Python and the Holy Grail. So determining a witch's guilt or innocence by sinking or floating in water seems weird, but apparently not that far from what really happened.
Yeah, so the trial by ordeal, as it was known, was commonly used in European countries for a long time, about 900 years ago. And the reason I started the book with that example was to show us how something that looks so absurd to our eye today made a lot of sense to the people back then. In a world in which people had great faith in God's ability to control the natural elements, it made a lot of sense that if you threw an innocent person into water, well, God would show you that they were innocent. And if you threw a guilty person, God would show you that they were guilty by having the pure water expel the person. Basically, guilty people floated. So why I start the book with this is I want to suggest that our current system will look just as unfair, just as absurd to our, the people 900 years in the future as this trial by ordeal looks to us today.
So they'll be snickering in the future. Which is interesting because I think in terms of, science and medical science and things like that, that in the future they'll think, oh, my God, what were they thinking back then? But I guess I never extended that to the justice system. But that's what you're saying, is that they'll be snickering a couple hundred years down the road about what we're doing now.
Yeah, or at least, treating our episodes of Law and Order as comedy shows or farce. And so the book is really about trying to lay out these hidden forces that are shaping people's behavior, judges, jurors, witnesses, detectives, and others. So each chapter sort of looks at a different one of these characters and contrasts the conventional common stories that we tell about how these people make decisions and where things can go wrong with what the latest evidence from psychology and neuroscience has to say.
Is the essence then that the system itself is not a terrible structure, but that it is populated by that most infallible of creatures, human beings? Most fallible of human creatures?
Yes and no. I mean, I think where my book really departs from the stories that, we're learning about in the mainstream media is I don't think it's about bad people. I don't think the problems with police brutality that we're seeing across the country, I don't think the examples of terrible conditions in prison are about people who are evil, who are trying to hurt other people. I think it's largely about sort of these hidden cognitive forces which are shaping people's actions beyond their awareness or control. So I would say it's not a story about bad apples. It's a story about things within us and around us that determine outcomes without us being aware of them.
Is it as simple as, for example, the analysis that NBA referees call more fouls on the visiting team because everybody wants to be liked and the fans are screaming for that?
You know, I think actually the sports analogy is really an interesting one because, with recent Supreme Court nominations, it's become very common for anyone who wants to get through the confirmation process to say, well, I'm just going to be an umpire justice, right?
Oh, like
Chief
Justice Roberts. Yeah,
balls and strikes. and I'm going to just apply the clear law to the facts, and that's how you become a good judge. You put all of your biases to the side. Now, what we know now about judicial psychology is that all judges are susceptible to numerous biases, and some of these are somewhat expected. We tend to acknowledge them only when we're talking about, if we're a liberal, it's people, conservative judges, it's Justice Scalia. If we're a conservative, it's the liberal judges who are activists. So we acknowledge some of this with respect to ideological bias, but there's a whole range of factors that influence judges beyond their awareness. So one of my favorite studies from the book is with respect to the decision whether to grant someone parole. So they looked at parole boards, actual parole boards in Israel. And, you know, I'm a criminal law professor. I teach my students. The things that would matter here would be how severe the crime was that the person committed and how they acted in prison, right? Did they reform? Did they show remorse? So the researchers found that what best predicted whether someone would be granted parole was not those things that law professors say are important. Rather, it was the time of day when the person came before the parole board. If they came first thing in the morning, they had the greatest chance of being released. If they came right before the first break in the day, that was the absolute worst time to come before the judge. Again, these things are supposed to be completely irrelevant. It's not supposed to matter what the judge had for breakfast, and yet the latest research suggests that it does matter.
Well, but are there correlations? I mean, things like blood sugar or attentiveness? I mean, how deeply does the study drill?
So we're trying to figure out still what the actual causal mechanism here. So the authors in this study thought, well, maybe this is something about low blood sugar, essentially. The idea that our brains run on glucose, and so when you have spent a number of hours away from having food, you actually tend to start, your brain sort of needs more energy, and when you're sort of in this state of sort of being depleted, you're more likely to stick with the status quo. And the status quo is leaving the person in prison. It's much cognitively more difficult in order to go against the status quo and release someone out of the community early. So at least that's the theory. Now, this was a correlational study, and it was fairly recently, so we're still trying to work out what the causal mechanism, but the correlation is strong and frightening.
We'll talk more with Professor Adam Benferrato about his book, Unfair, The New Science of Criminal Injustice, and we'll take your phone calls and emails as well. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Adam Benferrato and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is Adam Benferrato, an associate professor of law at Drexel University and a veteran of the criminal justice system from a couple of different vantage points. His book about the system is called Unfair, The New Science of Criminal Injustice. He takes a lot of neuroscience and other up-to-date technologies to take a look at what's going on in the criminal justice system and the fact that it is populated by people with all their foibles and fallibilities. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 throughout the listening area, 800-838-3760. Send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Adam, I have to believe this book was finished or nearly so by the time of the Ferguson shooting. Did that change anything about what you put in it?
No, I mean, I think the timing, certainly, I think the book really has a lot to say about these recent events, not just in Ferguson, but in Baltimore, at Rikers more recently, things that are happening in California, Chicago. And so I think the story with respect to police brutality is a lot more complicated than what we're hearing from, you know, the left or the right. So on the right, I think the story is that, you know, basically we've achieved a post-racial society, and there are just obviously a few bad apples left in police departments. These type of incidents are inevitable when you're dealing with such large numbers. And so we shouldn't get too worked up about it, and we certainly shouldn't be out protesting or rioting. On the left, I think the story is that we haven't actually made very much progress from the 1950s. Racism is still, explicit racism and bigotry is still very much alive and well, very pervasive within police departments. I don't think either of those stories are likely capturing what's going on. I think the more likely story and the more the biggest threat that young African-American men face is actually from well-intentioned police officers who believe themselves to actually not be racist, who are operating based on the same damaging stereotypes that we're all exposed to, which link blackness and violence and crime. And so there's really good research on the power of these implicit processes, particularly implicit racial bias. And there's actually been research done on shooter behavior. So in experiments, it's been documented that people have trouble when the target doesn't match up to the stereotype that they have in their head with respect to shooter bias. They're make more mistakes when holding their fire with an unarmed black person. And this obviously is playing out in the real world with really, really tragic consequences.
What do you mean they make more mistakes when holding their fire?
So in these experiments, you're brought in sort of a simulator type thing where you're shown, say, image flashes up of either a black man or a white man in an urban setting holding either a gun or, say, a wallet or a cell phone, and you're told, sort of in the role of a police officer, and indeed they've done these same experiments with actual police officers, you're told you need to hold your fire whenever you see an unarmed person, and you need to fire whenever you see a dangerous armed person. So people make more errors when encountering an unarmed black person than when they encounter an unarmed white person. And conversely, they actually make more errors with respect to an armed white person. So this is an interesting twist to the story, which is, you know, it's not just that officers are, you know, endangering young African-American men. It's also that they're at risk themselves because they don't respond correctly or they respond less accurately when confronted with dangerous white people.
Adam Benferrato is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Unfair, The New Science of Criminal Injustice. There's a great opening example in the book about ways in which labels get applied and assumptions are made, and they are wrong. Tell us about the old drunk guy on the Washington, D.C. street in the cold.
Yeah, so this is, you know, it's a winter night, and this guy goes out to get something out of his car, and he sees this man lying on his back on the sidewalk. So he goes up, and the man is sort of trying to sit up, but he's unable to speak. He's kind of moaning, keeps falling over. So the guy goes into his house, calls 911, and, you know, the first one to arrive is a fire truck. And as soon as the fire truck arrives, the man on the ground begins to vomit. And one of the firefighters says, I smell alcohol. This looks like an ETOH, a drunk. And so when the police arrive, they say, wait, it's just a drunk. No need to do any investigation here. When the EMTs arrive, they kind of forego some of the normal protocols. They put him in the back. They don't take him to the nearest hospital, as is required. They go to one that's more convenient for running some personal errands. And when the man is left in the hospital, he's just sort of set in a side hallway to sleep it off. Again, it's just a drunk. Well, everything changes when a nurse sees this man start to demonstrate the symptoms not of an alcoholic, but rather of someone with a head injury. And they rush him into surgery, but it's too late. And as they are in the surgery, they start to notice these things that they missed before. The man's pocket has been ripped. Back pocket has been ripped. He actually has, you know, an area of his head that appears to have suffered blunt force trauma. And it's only a coincidence that they later find out that this man is the subject of a horrible crime. He actually ended up being hit in the head by a couple of assailants. This man, who they assumed was a homeless drunk, turned out to be an award-winning New York Times reporter who'd gotten the hiccups and decided to go on a walk around the neighborhood in hopes of a brisk air cure. And what I think this case really shows and why I start with it is how our brains often, you know, we sum people up very, very quickly. And once we've summed them up, though, we don't revisit that initial set of assumptions. And in fact, we pass on those labels we attach to people to others, and that shapes their behavior. So here, this man who was initially labeled drunk from just this little tiny signal, someone thinking that they smell alcohol on this person's breath, how that shaped the entire trajectory of this case. You know, it was the reason that they ended up catching the people who did this to this man was because one of them simply felt remorseful and turned himself in. In a lot of cases, that never happens, and it's very frightening to think about as a victim how the color of your skin, the smell on your breath, the shape of your face, your clothes, how those things can determine whether you receive justice or injustice, and indeed might determine whether you live or die.
And the person who died in this case was David Rosenbaum, who was retired from the New York Times. So was it the evidence of the crime that spurred police into action or the discovery of who this was?
So the whole conception of the case changed as soon as they realized who this was. I mean, this was a luminary in Washington, D.C. for decades. And so when he was John Doe, the machinery of the criminal justice system moved very slowly, if at all. Once he was David Rosenbaum, everything changed. The entire conception of the case changed. The in terms of the people who were prosecuted, they, you know, the D.C. government used their best resources. They got both of these guys on long prison sentences. They agreed to adopt changes to some of the protocols in terms of how EMTs and firefighters respond. There were changes made with the police department. And so this kind of shows us that the idea that all victims are equal in the eyes of the law is not at all true. We treat people based on how old they are and what they look like, and that's a problem. That is not the equal justice that we promise.
You know, and you even go so far as to talk about how disgust on a physical level works into a more abstract level, where if somebody's faced with something disgusting, they find the whole situation disgusting. So, which leads to the question, do you think if David Rosenbaum hadn't vomited, he might be alive?
You know, the vomit was one of the most interesting aspects of this case, because it's brought up in the, you know, subsequent investigation of this tragedy. Many of the people bring up the vomit. And obviously, in our daily lives, when you smell vomit, you have a very strong disgust reaction. And one of the things that psychologists have found is that this emotion of disgust, we both have sort of physical disgust and we have moral disgust. So you can be disgusted by, say, reading about cannibalism in the Jamestown settlement, even though you're not experiencing, you're not seeing it, you're not smelling anything. It's more the thought of it, which is disgusting. And what we see is there's these two things can, for lack of a better word, kind of get confused in our brain. So when we experience physical disgust, that actually can lead us to feel more moral disgust. So if you're making a judgment, smelling a bad smell, that may lead you to actually condemn someone more harshly based on some moral transgression. And so it's quite likely, I think, in this case, although again it's a single anecdote, that vomit actually did directly play into how David was treated.
Adam Benferrato teaches law at Drexel University in Philadelphia. His book is Unfair, The New Science of Criminal Injustice. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone around the region, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So in this case, the ETOH, this is ethyl alcohol, was the original identification of the case, just an old drunk. Once labels are applied, what do scientists, brain researchers, psychologists, neuroscientists tell us about how difficult it is to undo the labels we've applied?
Well, one of the things is once these labels are attached, once we have a causal story of what happened, we're very loath to revisit it. In fact, we tend to then conform all the other evidence that we come across in order to fit into the boxes that we've already made for ourselves. So in this case, once you think, well, this guy's a drunk, you start acting differently. You stop looking, right, for whether this looks like a crime because you already have this individual theory. You don't test the person's, cognitive ability because you already have this theory in place. And one of the things that's really interesting is this affects almost every character in our criminal justice system. So it certainly affects police officers. It also affects judges. So judges operate with blinders. We know really interesting research done on when justices go off and do research on certain topics, basically factual research. Well, a lot of times they already know the outcome that they expect to be true, and so they selectively look for sources that already support that. One of the most frightening examples of how this is a problem in our criminal justice system is actually with respect to forensic evidence. So someone, lab technician, doing a fingerprint test, seeing if that's a match. Well, you think that's just cut and dry. You know, do the certain patterns of the thumbprint match or don't they match? Well, scientists have actually looked at that, and they find that when the person doing that forensic analysis knows that this person is the suspect and, say, an eyewitness has already identified them, they're a lot more likely to find that it's a match than when they are not provided with that evidence. And that's one of the reasons I think we really need to move towards blind procedures where the people analyzing the evidence don't know whether or not this is the suspect or not.
Oh, like number six matches sample A, that sort of thing, where you really don't know which case you're dealing with.
Yep.
Yeah, it makes a certain amount of sense. Let's take a call. We have a caller going by the name of Jane Doe in Humboldt County. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Adam Ben Ferrato, the author of Unfair.
Yes, hello. Good morning. Thank you, Adam, for your work, and thank you all for having this conversation. I'm calling from Humboldt, and the reason why I'm calling is I have a personal interest in the issue of the way that judges are acting. And I want to encourage everybody to realize how important it is to follow your judicial elections and vote for your judges. Mm-hmm. Locally, we're having this conversation nationally about police brutality and about police bias and about racism. And I just really want to bring it home because what my experience is that last September I attended as a spectator a homicide trial in Eureka of a mixed-race man. And I had reason to suspect that this was a malicious prosecution, that he was being framed. And that's why I went to it. Enforcement knew that I suspected that, and enforcement was implicated. And what happened was, during the proceeding, the judge told the court reporter to go off record. The court reporter went off record, and evidence continued to be presented against the defendant. It was video evidence, and it was not entirely audible. There were three characters in it, and one of them you couldn't hear very well. So this went on for several minutes, and the jury and everyone except for the public had been handed transcripts, which supposedly represented the dialogue in the video. When I realized that as a member of the public, I didn't have access to those transcripts, and I knew that the prosecutor, who was our former DA, Paul Gallegos, is a very controversial character, could have put anything into those transcripts so that an appeals judge and that jury, that judge would take his word for what the people in the video were saying. I realized that this man was, the defendant was experiencing a real violation of his constitutional right to a public trial. Mm-hmm. That concerned me enough that I stood up and I whispered to the bailiff. I explained to him what I just explained to you. I said, you need to please pass out copies of the transcripts to the press, to the public and the press, because this guy isn't.
And were they ever, those transcripts, delivered?
No, they were never passed out. And what happened instead was the bailiff took note of it. I sat back down. And the in the audience, there were sitting uniformed officers, which I later found out was something they were doing to target me and to intimidate me, was putting a bunch of uniformed officers in these trials. seated among the public. And so I approached one of them, and I said the same thing, and he said, I'll take care of it. I sat back down. The situation kept continuing. It was a pretty long video. And so after another, you know, 15 minutes into this thing, I stood up in the spectators area, and I started walking. And that was when the bailiff and two sheriff deputies jumped on me, started doing pain compliance without giving commands, picked me up off the ground in front of the judge and jury, and physically carried me out of the courtroom.
Have you been charged?
No, they didn't charge me with anything. What they attempted to do was have me institutionalized as gravely disabled, which means locked up in a nut ward for life.
So some of the things that you mentioned here certainly resonate with me. One of the messages that I want to get out with this book is just the vital importance of transparency. People need to know what's really going on, and that means both revealing the psychological processes, which are largely hidden to members of the public, but it's also about understanding what actually happens during an interrogation. What actually happens in that initial police stop. And so there's been a lot of talk in California and elsewhere on the importance of cameras and the need to tape more things. And this has been offered up as, I think, this will solve a lot of our problems. If we have more squad car cameras, if we record all interrogations from the very second they start to the end, and then we provide them to jurors, we provide them to members of the public. And I think there is a grain of truth, more than a grain of truth. I think when people know that they are being videotaped, they act differently. There's good evidence to support that. The thing that worries me a little bit is, and this is what brings up the interesting point about the difference between a transcript and a watching the video.
Okay, hold the thought.
Those are not the same thing.
Because we need to take a break here. Unfair is the book, The New Science of Criminal Injustice. We'll come back and talk about differences between transcripts and videos with Adam Benferrato and you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Adam Benferrato, Associate Professor of Law at Drexel University. He's the author of a book on the criminal justice system called Unfair, The New Science of Criminal Injustice. Details the issues with our justice system, largely revolving around the fact that human beings are imperfect and make mistakes, and sometimes not just mistakes, but also some errors of commission as well. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the subject matter, 800-838-3760 around the region by email jx@jeffnet.org. And Adam, you were just about to talk about the problem with video versus transcripts of videos and things like that.
Yeah, so we tend to think that video evidence just provides an unfiltered lens on events. Finally, we can see what really happened. But the thing about video is we're always being offered a frame on events, and that frame is very powerful. It can shape who we see as responsible, how we feel about things. So one of the interesting the most interesting research in this area involves interrogations. And what these experimenters did was they put a camera behind the detective doing the interrogation, and they put a camera behind the person being interrogated. Now, we would assume that people would feel very similarly no matter what footage they saw, but that was not what the researchers found. Instead, when the camera was behind the detective, people watched the footage and said, well, that was a completely voluntary confession, no problems at all. But when people were watching events through the eyes of the person being interrogated, the suspect, suddenly they began to appreciate all of the coercive elements. And many people decided, well, that actually looks like a coerced interrogation. It shouldn't come in at all. Now, the way to address this problem is to make sure in interrogations that we always offer a third-party perspective. And I think the broader point here is we just have to be very careful with respect to video evidence and not sort of seeing it as a complete way to solve all of our problems.
What is the read approach to interviews and interrogations that you mention in the book?
So I'm very interested in why we have false confessions. For a long time, we thought false confessions were an impossibility. They were scarcely conceivable. But But with the advent of DNA evidence, we've started to realize, no, they actually are far more common than we could ever have believed. And I think the reason for them has to do with this Reed technique, which is the most commonly used interrogation procedure in the United States. And the problems with it stem from the particular protocol that's used. The first thing that a detective is charged with doing is determining whether the suspect is lying or not. The problem with that is humans are very bad at judging deceit from demeanor. So the exact elements that we suppose are good tells that someone is lying, say jittery limbs or averting one's gaze, those are actually really, really bad ways to tell whether someone's telling the truth or not. Now, once the detective determines that someone is lying under the Reed technique, the next step is simply to get a confession. And the techniques that are used here are called minimization and maximization, loosely a sort of good cop, bad cop strategy. And the problem here in experiments is this puts an enormous amount of pressure on people to confess just to alleviate the stress. And what innocent people often think is, well, I'm experiencing this acute distress and I just need some way to relieve it. I will confess, I'll be able to get out of this small room with these people yelling at me, and, you know, over the next week, the truth will come out. They'll find other evidence, my alibi will check out, everything will be fine. And the problem is, as soon as you confess, because people believe that is such powerful evidence, the police stop looking for anyone else. They don't follow up on any of those leads. And that's really, I think, how we get to these really atrocious cases, many of which I discuss in the book.
So you can't go upside somebody's head anymore, and so there's no physical coercion in most cases that we know of anyway. But how does the Supreme Court and how do lower courts generally view things like trickery or telling a suspect a lie in order to get them to admit something?
Yeah, so I think, you know, one of the reasons that we are in the bad situation that we are is that we have gotten rid of a lot of the explicit coercion, and we think that we're safe. So judges think, well, you know, we used to use the third degree. People were actually beaten up and confessed. And so we've gotten rid of all of that stuff, and we feel safe, but we know the psychological coercion is just as powerful, ultimately. And so with respect to Supreme Court regulations, they tend to turn a blind eye to a lot of the trickery, the lying. You can't, in many cases, you can't fabricate evidence. And the reason you can't do it, what they're concerned about, is that that fake evidence will eventually make its way into trial. What they're not worried about is lying to someone. And the danger is that lying actually can result in false confessions. One of the cases that hit me very hard that I read about was this story about this boy who wakes up, and I believe his mother was already dead. His father was bleeding to death, and he's brought in as the main suspect. And one of the police officers on the case pretends to have a conversation with someone at the hospital and says, then comes back and says, hey, yeah, so your dad just woke up from his coma. And yeah, the first words out of his mouth is that you did it. And so the boy ends up confessing. The truth of the matter is the father never woke up. The father died. But this boy ended up spending over 10 years in prison for murdering his parents when he was completely innocent.
It's an amazing story. There are several amazing stories in this book. Let's take a phone call from Robin in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Adam Benferrato, the author of Unfair.
Thank you for taking my call. I think that justice, like politicians, are for sale. You need to have at least $1 million in order to afford the legal help, anyone that's competent. If you do not have millions of dollars, forget about justice. There is no justice. Mm-hmm. What you end up doing is either plea bargaining or having the prosecutor and the police and the judges try to run you through the court system as quickly as possible, regardless of whether you're guilty or innocent. I have very little faith unless, again, you have millions of dollars and able to get a lawyer that has some track record in representing people who are, again, just grind it through the system without thinking about justice at all.
All right, Robin, thanks for the perspective. Let's get a response from Adam.
I think that's a fabulous point, and one that I actually spend a major part of one of the chapters talking about, which is that all of these psychological biases that I've been talking about, that I've been suggesting are hidden to most of the people in our criminal justice system, well, some people know about this stuff, and that's the trial consulting industry, which has grown immensely. A lot of these people are PhDs in psychology, and that access to that information is so valuable because you then know you can. That's so helpful in picking juries, with preparing witnesses, and that really stacks the cards so much in favor of the people who can afford those very expensive services. Poor people can't. And so poor people are stuck with a system that's already biased against them with no understanding of how to game that system. And so I think that this is a major source of inequality. The other thing that's really disturbing is not just plea bargaining, but rather the effects of inequality with respect to bail. So a lot of poor people end up having to sit in jail. And in certain jurisdictions in the United States, I'm talking sitting in jail for 50, 100, 200, 300 days in jail in very brutal conditions because they can't come up with $1,000, $5,000 for bail. I think that cannot stand. I think we need to reform our bail system immediately in jurisdictions across the country.
There's a great section in the book about thinking we know something about people and the kinds of people they are. You bring up the case of Phineas Gage, who had the blasting rod or the tamping rod blast through his head, and it made him a lot madder. You follow it up with the case of Mr. Oft, the school teacher, who became a sexual deviant, but the reasons are just amazing.
Yeah, so in this chapter, I'm really looking at what causes crime ultimately. Is it about evil people, bad, corrupt souls? What's really the source? And so I start to look at the neuroscience here. And this case of Mr. Oft is particularly interesting as an anecdote because it's a case where this man, you know, 40-year-old school teacher, starts to develop these aberrant sexual impulses. He starts to collect child pornography, actually sexually abuses his or approaches his stepchild. And so he's sent away because he's a first-time offender, to a diversion program. And, you know, while at the Sexaholics Anonymous course, he's propositioning the teacher. And so he's going to be sent to prison. Suddenly he develops this terrible headache. He's taken to the emergency room, and they find a very large tumor inside his brain. The tumor is removed. All of those sexual impulses appear to disappear. But then a number of months later, his wife discovers that he's collecting pornography again. And so he's taken back to the doctor, and they find that the tumor has grown back. And when they remove it, as far as we know, all of those impulses disappear. Now, why I find this story so interesting is that I think it gives us clear evidence that the origins of crime come from the brain. And so we really need to understand more about the factors that shape people's brains. If you look at the broad statistical evidence, brain abnormalities are correlated with criminal behavior. We know that people who have suffered traumatic brain injuries are overrepresented in our prisons. And we know that people with certain severe mental health problems, which are related to brain abnormalities, are overrepresented in prisons. And so I think that we need to have that conversation as a country about what it means if the origins of crime happen in the brain, and often as a result of exposure to heavy metals as a child, suffering brain trauma. If that's the cause of criminal behavior, I think that changes how we punish.
The heavy metals one is a huge one in here, so, because it made me say, what? Lead in gasoline, you think, might figure in the sharp rise in violent crime from the 60s on?
Yeah, so the research is really, really interesting. We know that we had this big bump in violent crime that happened, and really creative researchers actually looked at exposure to leaded gasoline that was happening, say, in the 40s and 50s. So these people, when they were infants, were exposed to leaded gasoline, the theory goes. And so when they ended up being in their 20s, they were committing violent crimes. The research is really good about the correlation between exposure to heavy metals and certain antisocial behavior. So again, this is ongoing research. We're learning more and more, but it's certainly a fascinating theory.
So when I look at the sum total of things, you know, actually when I was driving home last night, this occurred to me that we always talk about doing things on a case-by-case basis. You know, that every case is different. We have to consider each case on its merits. But it seems like what often happens, the way you portray the criminal justice system, is that we think in terms of, oh, I've seen this one before, and it gets lumped into a category.
I think that's true. I mean, I think that people, I mean, we all do this. I mean, regardless of your occupation, we all are operating on autopilot a lot of the time. We operate based on stereotypes and other associations. And so this can get us into a lot of trouble. Some of the time, it's great, right? It saves us time. We can multitask. We can do lots of things. But it also can get us into terrible trouble.
So what are some of the remedies that you propose for the criminal justice system, Adam?
I think the biggest one is that we need to commit ourselves to evidence-based law. So the medical establishment went through a similar process over a number of years, rejecting anecdote and rejecting baseless assumptions and saying medical care needs to be based on the best available empirical research. The business community more recently has undergone the same sort of transformation. The legal system, for one reason or another, has been resistant to incorporating and responding to insights from the behavioral sciences about how judges, jurors, detectives, and others actually behave. And so I think we need to commit to a realistic model of human behavior. We need to know what actually deters people. It turns out that harsh sentences are very, very ineffective. What's much more effective is actually putting more police on the streets so that people are aware that if they commit a crime, they're more likely to get caught.
We have barely gotten our feet wet in the book. It's a really comprehensive look at things. Unfair, the New Science of Criminal Injustice. Adam Ben-Ferrato wrote it, and he joined us today. Adam, thanks so much.
It was a pleasure. Thanks.